Accession number 23213, reel 19.
Major Potts, reel 19. I think you were responsible for the map
Yeah.
store on Ark Royal.
Yeah, well, you see, we had all these maps. We also had maps. Some of them were out of date. They hadn't been remapped. For instance, we did one exercise in Denmark where we had to send the aircraft to bomb an airfield. When we got the maps out, the one in 50,000, we couldn't find the airfield on it. And when we looked, the map was made in 1879, and that was the most up-to-date map of that part of Denmark. We also had a course all the way to Moscow. It was a big job.
How was it that you were in charge of that particular?
Because I was responsible for all operations over
All
on the
that land.
land. We had Norway to the north, right up to the Murmansk, and all the way down.
So these were air operations.
Air operations, yeah, because we didn't have a landing or anybody on board. I had one other officer with me who was a gunner, and he was trained in naval gunfire support.
Called observation officer.
Yeah. And then I had a staff sergeant, a clerk, and a driver. Very important, the driver, because I had a Land Rover on board. We had a micro library of all potential targets. I also used to do, when we were at sea, the GT, the gun, GDP, whatever that stands for, I can't remember now. Gun something direction platform. The aircraft were firing out of float being towed behind the aircraft carrier. When one day we had a Russian submarine came up, we asked them to come aboard. The captain asked them to come aboard for a drink, but they wouldn't.
Where was that?
It was somewhere between Malta and Gibraltar.
In the Med.
Yeah, in the Med.
Wouldn't have been so surprising in the North Norwegian Sea.
No, well, we went up there. The other thing I had to do for one tour on board, 1 6-month tour, was to produce the daily paper, because everybody had an extra job to do. I used to produce a 6-page, ship's news and world newspaper. We used to go to America quite a lot, and we did exercises in Vieques. Vieques had the most marvelous range. It's just off Puerto Rico, about 12 miles, and it had a range, a sea range, with electric controlled boats. It had a airfield with old aeroplanes on it. And in fact, we used it for bombing and strafing. And it was an excellent range. Oh, and it had moving tanks, radio controlled. And it was a great place to go. And it was here that I was telling you earlier that if you dropped your 1,000-pounders too low, they didn't own. So they all had to be destroyed. Exactly the same.
Change the fuses down so they wouldn't own.
Well, that was up to them on board. Somebody had to go and blow those blooming bombs up later. This was very much typical of what happened in the Falklands, that the Argentinians let their bombs go too low.
They had to fly low to avoid the
Yeah,
anti-air
but if you go too low and you can't deliver your weaponry, you're not doing too well. The we also managed to shoot down an American seaplane. Well, they thought it was a drone, and it was an American two-engine seaplane. And they put a, I mean, it was a sidewinder up into one of the engines. Nobody was hurt.
You managed to get out, didn't
you? Yeah, it got out, yeah. We weren't too popular. That was nothing to do with me, I might add. We also went to the Med, and we dropped bombs on Spartivento, which is a big naval. It was here that I got into a bit of trouble.
Was this incurring the displeasure of the Admiralty Board?
It was.
And how did you do that?
Would you like to know?
I would like to know about that.
Well, I was thrown off at La Maddalena, and we motored south to Cape Spartivento, and we were going to be there 5 days on the south of the island to do live firing with buccaneers and phantoms. Anyway, what happened was it was all going splendidly, and we had various air crews coming, twos or ones, and they were under FAC control onto the, it wasn't very difficult because it was a point, you know, it was a cape. Anyway, we had one pair which was split, and we didn't know it. And the leader came and dropped his bombs, and then this, when he said, bomb's gone, the other clown let his bombs go. And he dropped them on the Aga Khan's beach.
The
Aga Khan was not on his beach, but the 2 1,000-pounders ended up on the beach, bang, bang. Well, you can imagine the Aga Khan's, whoever was in charge, was a bit annoyed. I maintain to this day that the air crew only had the map of the London Underground with them. Anyway, within half an hour, half of the Italian carabinieri on Sardinia arrived, and we beat a hasty retreat calling for a helicopter. And anyway, there was the most mighty court of inquiry. We managed to get the front page of the Times and Telegraph, and anyway, the long and the short of it was that well, about 2 months later, the captain received a letter from the Board of Admiralty saying that the following had incurred the displeasure of the Board of Admiralty. Captain Gerard Pierce, RN, Joe Worth, who was the commander air, the two air crew who were in the Phantom, and me. And anyway, first of all, I went in, had to get dressed up and go in and salute the captain. The secretary was there. And he read out the thing, and he, or before it all started, the captain said, well, don't worry too much, because nothing's really about this, it's very important. He said, I just got a signal today, say I've been promoted to admiral. So I said, well, I haven't got a signal today saying I've been promoted to colonel. So he said, okay, well, we'll have this formal thing. We had the formal thing, and the secretary read out the charge. And he said, is that your name, rank, and number? You see, and they read it out. And at the end, instead of having Royal Irish, it had Royal Marines. And I said, I'm afraid it's wrong. I'm Royal Irish Rangers, not Royal Marines. Oh, said the captain. Oh, what are we going to do about that, secretary? And the secretary said, we'd better send it back to the Admiralty. So it was sent back to the Admiralty. And I never heard any more about it. It never came back again. And I was very upset because I wanted a copy of it, even if it was only a photostat copy from my loo. And that was how I incurred the displeasure of the Naval Board. It was my final job in the Army, and I thoroughly enjoyed my 2 years or so with the Royal Navy.
Did you know that at the time that it was going to be your last?
I put in for redundancy. I knew that after that the sort of jobs I would get would be officer in charge of sanitation at Salisbury Plain, or they did offer me the job of permanent president of courts martial. I didn't think I was a suitable type for that job.
Well, you had personal experience.
Well, I had personal experience, but I decided that perhaps that was not my be-all and end-all. I would say, though, in my defence, that in the FACing world, that I did, you know, I did a total of 362 live FAC strikes and 1,235 dummies, and DS on training 784, which would add up to somewhere around about 2,380, which most probably is something like 50 times more than an ordinary FAC would ever get anywhere at any time, especially today where the aircraft are even faster.
Was that the only occasion which you had a sort of accident or mishap?
Yeah, it was. We'd had no other. We had an aircraft crash doing FAC training in Devon. We had a Hunter went in.
Was that pilot error or some other reason?
He had something wrong with the plane. He parachuted, technical error, and the plane. Unfortunately, it was full of ammunition, live ammunition, and that wasn't my fault. Nothing to do with me. But it was. It had gone to do something in Wales, couldn't fire, and they thought it was going to fire in Wales, then come back and do two tummy attacks for me. But we had that was the only one. And when they checked out, the people who were wrong on this one in Sardinia, that was just carelessness. But they did at least get some T-shirts made, and everybody, including the captain, got one called Cape Spartivento bombing cruise.
You were mentioning earlier on working at the American Rangers. How do you get on with the Americans?
It's a different way of life. I mean, in a service helicopter in those days, you would never have smoked. The Americans go along chewing a big cigar. They were very accommodating. They were very helpful. I went on the Forrestal, which was a carrier there. They wanted me to go to sea on it. They couldn't make out why I was on the strike planning as a mere major. You had to be at least a captain in the American Navy to be on the strike planning team. They're over-controlled, I think. Really are over-controlled, the Americans. They don't encourage free thought, but there you are.
What, did you have an opportunity to see how they carried out their forward air control?
I'm just thinking. I don't think there's any difference to us because we had Americans on our course. The courses I ran in the UK.
Yeah.
I used to have NATO, you see. Americans, Germans, Norwegians, Turks. I wouldn't like to be in too near the Turks when they were flying. I can't think of anybody else. French. No, they didn't have the French because the French weren't part of NATO. Italians. And they all came on the FAC courses at Givna. So we had a pretty good cross-section. And the Americans, okay, yeah, they knew. It was the same procedure. All the procedures on FAC when I left were the same because they had to be because it was NATO. Because when I left, it was standardization of NATO, and it was still the threat was Germany and the hordes. Now, I don't think it's changed all that much now.
You mentioned you had a target library on the Ark Royal.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? Did that come down from the Admiralty?
I think it came from the Joint Services, whoever it is, Strike Command. I mean, there were only three people who were allowed to look at it, and that was the Commander Air, and there were four, actually. Commander Air, Captain, Ops 1 and myself. It was a micro library. It had an orbital.
What's a micro library?
Hmm.
What is a micro library?
Well, they're just little micro.
It's on microfilm.
Yeah, micro dots. They were micro dots on a piece of card. And if you drop one tray, it took you a whole day to sort them out, put them back in order.
It could be a whole country gone.
About half or quarter, yeah. I didn't do it, but Ops One did. Mm. And there were only four people who had the key to get in there. Once you were in there, you were signed in, and you stayed there until you got yourself signed out again. Very interesting. I'm not quite certain how well we would have been sunk by the time we had launched our aircraft.
Well, that's the question, that aircraft carriers were suspected of being far too vulnerable to be useful, weren't they?
Yeah.
Hence the decision.
Well, you don't know. You see, one of my jobs was to brief over the terrain, but can you really brief over terrain that you've never seen? And from a map, all I used to say to the crew was, if you get, you're coming back, if you get shot down and you meet a polar bear, remember to run downhill because they can't run downhill.
When the Ark Royal was going on exercises, was it always accompanied by a large force of escorts?
A couple of destroyers or frigates. It was a very good piece of equipment. It would have saved, I think, if it's still being commissioned 4 years after it was decommissioned during the Falklands.
Yes.
It would have saved us losing any of those ships. Because it had the early warning system.
And air defence capability.
Air defence capability, yeah. But there you are.
Do you remember taking part in any large scale multinational exercises?
Oh, yeah. There were sort of things like the big one that went from Norway down to Gib, and we were one of the aircraft carriers giving. Giving support. I think the best one, and we used to come back from Gib, we used to give the submarines a scare, because we used to come back at 30 knots plus for a period of time. The submarines couldn't keep, even the nukes couldn't keep up. But she was old. You know, we ran out of water, we ran out of this, we ran out of that. I mean, she was put down in 1942.
But she'd been refitted, hadn't she, and upgraded?
Yeah, but a lot of they couldn't get the generators out because they were old, and you had to cut open the decks to get them up.
Through.
Yeah. So that is really my all I can tell you about my career. Whether it's a career that's interesting or not, I don't know.
You're going to tell me about an incident in career, I think, with. You and John
Mowell. Oh, yeah, we were one night about half past 2-3 o'clock. We were woken up and told that there was noise on the wire down in the valley in front of us, and we knew there were no patrols out from our positions, and we'd been told of no other friendly forces. So everybody stood to, got the illuminating flares, stood everybody to, put the flares up, and there, two or three, or a couple of hundred yards away, were this group of people, and we opened fire. And it was a patrol of the Gloucesters, lost by 4,000 metres. I think we wounded 8. We certainly didn't kill anybody, which I'm internally grateful.
How many of them were there altogether?
I think it was a patrol quite large, 15 or 18 or something like that. They got lost and they'd come up the wrong valley, and that was it, and straight into our position. If you get lost in those conditions, don't move. You should stay until first light and try and get out. But they had no communications with their base or anything. And our battalion headquarters had not been told by the Gloucesters that there was a patrol out.
So the repercussions as a result of that?
Oh, no, no. The CO just said, I mean, bloody awful shooting. End of story. But it's too easy to happen. You know, it can happen any time to anybody.
So, when you retired, did you find it difficult to adjust to civil life, having been in the army for so long?
No, I don't think so. I, you know, basically, I'm a lazy individual. No, I when I left, I found it slightly that I didn't have to go to work on Mondays. I did beekeeping for quite a long time. I had to get the house we're in at the moment sorted out and the garden sorted out. I had quite a lot to sort out. And then I worked for a couple of years, or a year, raising money for the local blind school. And then I became registrar of births, deaths and marriages for a few years, for about 4 or 5 years. And then I decided that it was time to go fishing and do all the things I wanted to do. And that is what I've done ever since.
What do you think are the advantages of having had a military career?
It's a very difficult question. I would say the great advantage was I'd never intended to have a military career. And I had to join the army because of national service. I joined. I was regimented. I enjoyed it. I then wanted to be a regular. So I became a regular. I think I've been very lucky in having a career that I did have, as compared with, say, sitting on the staff, distributing Mars bars to people. I really had two bites of the cherry. I had my active service, which was fairly good and enjoyable, if you call active service enjoyable. I had an exciting time. And my second half was doing something else, which I found I enjoyed, was training and or related subjects. And I never had a dull job. And so therefore, when I thought I was going to get a dull job, I decided that it was time for me to go. And I think a lot of people should do that instead of hanging on, hoping that things will get better, because they won't as you get older. And that's my life.